Radio City, our Sweet 16 edition. John Grayson and Rob Ross here with you, talking a little bit about what's going on out there in the world and in here on PopDose.com. Rob, how's your week so far?
So far, it's been really good, John. How are you doing?
Outstanding, outstanding. Life is good. And, of course, the hype has begun to wear off after celebrating the 50th anniversary of Sgt. Pepper's for what seems like about a month now. But it's all starting to wind back down. And, you know, we talked about this last week in our segment on the show. But, you know, it's one of those things that I think, looking back on it now, bears some analysis of the wind down of all of the hype, because I mean, there's been the PBS documentary, there's the 50th anniversary edition of the music that's out from Giles Martin. There's still a lot going on.
Well, this is an album that does have its, quote, merits in the collective conscience, if you will, of the general public that was around to buy it and experience it when it came out. And subsequently, the generations that it's been handed down to, ours included. You know, when I spoke about it last week, I did say I thought it was the most overhyped album of all time. And I said that, you know, not in a sense of being contrarian or snarky or wanting to provoke anyone. I said it in the context of being a lifelong Beatles fan and someone who has always, A, set the framework of the Beatles by Revolver.
Right.
You know, and then everything contrasts and compares with that, to which, to me, it'll never change, because nothing can or will ever reach the collective vision that Revolver was versus the concept that Pepper became. You know, the other thing about Pepper that I've never truly cared for, and I don't think it has to do with the idea of the Summer of Love vibe or the hippie connotations. Revolver and I have to say the American Rubber Soul, those two albums, which were back to back, have completely unforgettable songs. There are no throwaways in my mind, in my heart, and and I know I'm going on a limb here, musical intellect. But with Sgt. Pepper, there are some highly forgettable songs.
Right, exactly. Yeah, and see, I would throw another album in there as well, because for me, it's that trilogy. It's Rubber Soul, Revolver, and Yesterday and Today. All three of them, I think, are in that same. Yesterday and Today is maybe about a half step down, but I still love it.
Well, you're also working on it from the American point of view. And granted, if you take those three versus the British Rubber Soul and Revolver, which I hate doing that because, like you, of course, I grew up with the Capitol releases.
Right.
But either way, you know, that period, late 65, December 65 through August 66, the Beatles reached an apex I don't feel anyone could ever match them with. And I know that there are a lot of people that will, of course, now take the mantle of Pet Sounds up. Mm-hmm. And say, well, were it not for Pet Sounds. I don't agree with that in total, because Pet Sounds was spurned on by Rubber Soul. Pet Sounds also is an entity of itself. You have to look at this. The Beatles were the brainchildren of Lennon and McCartney, and then to a lesser extent, Harrison's writings, and they were produced by George Martin. Anything and Everything by the Beach Boys was all Brian Wilson envisioned, imagined, produced, and directed by.
Right, right.
So there's a very, very big difference there, and a very different sensibility involved. Also, the American versus English contrasts.
Yeah. Well, see, and I look at the songs, and it just in terms of numbers of songs and quality of songs in terms of the band's canon, my comparison is to when Strummer and Jones went into a room and came out a couple of days later with Sandinista. That's... To me, that's, again, that creative apex with two guys just going at it and cranking out song after song after song. And every one of them you hear, you go, damn.
Well, the thing about, you know, Rubber Soul, Yesterday and Today, and Revolver, we'll put it in the framework that you and I grew up with.
Yeah.
You know, you go from starting off with I've Just Seen a Face to the very last notes fading out to Tomorrow Never Knows. And in between there, sandwiched, you'll find Nowhere Man, Yesterday.
Right.
If I Needed Someone, Tax Man, Got to Get You Into My Life.
And Your Bird Can Sing.
She Said, She Said.
Yeah.
You know, even one of the biggest novelty songs in the history of music was from the Beatles with Yellow Submarine. So there's little to no comparison, and Pepper in another frame of this whole canon of works, Pepper to me is a collection of songs that, taken on their own merits, like I said, there are some really good songs on that album. You know, some songs that, not because of what they mean or because they're popular, because of the ages, to me, when I hear them, I still enjoy listening to them, whether it's Lucy in the Sky, Good Morning, Good Morning, which is probably one of the more oft overlooked tracks from Pepper,
yep,
which is probably my favorite of all the songs on that album. Getting Better, you know, With a Little Help from My Friends. Beyond that, I don't find anything else that I would go out of my way to sit and listen all the way through. But the other important thing for me is this. When I was 13, one of my uncles gave me as a Christmas present the only to this day authorized biography of the Beatles written by Hunter Davies. And this was written back in 1966, 67, 68, during the period that the Beatles were writing and recording Pepper. And there is an anecdote in there where he's, you know, watching them going through the songwriting process together, you know, watching Lennon and McCartney. And during this you know, songwriting session, they would basically just shout anything out. One of them would sit at the piano and just anything that came to mind automatically. And I remember it was always from this book, that particular episode was Tits, Hitler, Duke of Edinburgh, Beatles. Okay. And at a point, Lennon says, and I know I'm paraphrasing here, but Lennon says something akin to, people believe because they want to believe, or he might have even been a little bit more bluff and crass about it. People are conned because they want to be conned. It was something along those lines.
Yeah.
You know, people don't want to know if, in fact, when we were writing She's Leaving Home, we were thinking about a bunch of bananas. You know? People want to believe the mythology.
Right.
That punctured something, actually, in my obviously very impressionable young teenage self, which I was never able to get back, because from then on I always thought, well, songwriting really isn't about the emotion and the feeling behind the song. It's about how well you can craft it. And while I got that concept, I think, pretty well down pat, I learned how to write songs for the sake of writing songs versus actually writing very emotionally and very personally poignant songs. I've done it, and they're not easy to do, but more often than not, I tend to just write because I can do that. I don't know if that's always the best way of approaching your songwriting craft, because, like I said, it took something away from me. It made me more of an automaton writer. It didn't lessen my ability or ruin my chances of honing that craft as I went on.
Yeah.
Because I think I refined it in a lot of ways over the years, but man, that was just a big crushing blow, to be honest with you. You know, when you're 13 years old, that hits very heavily. So in its own way, it was not great for me to see and read, which is part of the reason why now I look at Pepper with such a cynical eye, because it's really not about the peace and love and good vibes and all that joyful stuff, man. But instead, it was just a songwriting exercise of, okay, we got to write an album. And let's face it, a song like Mr. Kite, being for the benefit of Mr. Kite, as Lennon himself said, never mind the fact that it's been shown and pointed out physically and visually, you know, in documentaries and so on, all he did was connect the lists of every single thing that's advertised on the poster.
Yeah.
No effort in songwriting there whatsoever. The genius in all of that is, of course, what they did when they recorded the track, you know, with George Martin having been the one to come up with the idea of taking the tapes of Calliope sounds, cutting them up into strips, having them randomly tossed in the air by Jeff Emmerich, and then glued back together, you know, to see what would come out.
Yeah.
That's about it. But there's no great skill in writing the lyrics. And as you and I have talked about, certainly She's Leaving Home is just way too saccharine to a sickening degree that it just Time has not been kind to it.
No, and for a very good reason. You know, and it's funny, with all the hype that's still out there, I'm sure we're going to hear a lot about this record, but there's plenty more anniversaries coming up, and I'm looking forward to seeing what kind of recognition Abbey Road gets, what kind of recognition the White Album gets when we get to those 50s, because they're just around the corner within a year or two.
Exactly. You know, it took me, I would say, well over 30 years to finally, quote unquote, appreciate the White Album.
Yeah.
And that only happened after I finally got the CD of it and did what every other human being did once they had the CD. You know, I actually converted into the boiled down single version of the LP that it should have been. I still think mine, frankly, is the quintessential version because I think I hit it just right. But that's an album I can appreciate and listen to far more often than Sgt. Pepper. And it's not a knock on anybody's view or opinion. It's just that Pepper is of a time.
Right.
It hasn't aged that well. It's not Eternal Listening. Rubber Soul, Revolver, to a lesser degree, Abbey Road, which is also not one of my favorites, but still, that's one that has indeed aged very well, regardless. What my opinion is invalid compared to the overall scope of does this album still sound good? You better believe it.
Yeah.
Pepper just hasn't.
The one thing is, speaking of the White Album, that I would love to do, one of these days I will interview Elliot Easton and find out if he really did directly and intentionally rip off the guitar bit from I Will when he wrote My Best Friend's Girl. Because it's note for note identical.
She's my best friend's girl.
Took that into consideration. I'd never thought of that before. So that's something.
Something to listen to next time you hear both of them, especially back to back. But we've got a whole bunch more to go over. And one of the things that surprised me this week, looking around on Popdos, was that a song that initially I was ready to really not like very much kind of grew on me. And it grew on me over the course of just one listen through. And one that I thought I was going to like a lot kind of left me a little bit flat. And we're going to talk about both of them back to back because, well, we'll start out with the one that really grew on me because Chantal Monte ended up with a song that's on Popdos this week that was Alison Baran was the one who gave us the review on this one. Let's talk a little bit about this tune because it's called Everything and it's there for you in its entirety on the page along with her review. But for folks who don't know her, who is Chantal Monte?
She's actually a San Francisco native, from what I gather. Interestingly enough, I just want to say I found it kind of fascinating that this is not one of those that you would find in Allison's usual wheelhouse because she's more of the pop bands kind of writer slash aficionado. But hey, this is what's great about it is that she, like myself and so many others, have decided let's really take this to another level. So full marks and a tip of the hat to her for bringing us this particular track. But I should say, Chantal Monte seems to have that nouveau, and this is not a derogatory phrase, hippie vibe.
Yes.
You know, because she's talking about, certainly within the context of her lyrics, you know, meditation and sexuality and, you know, transcending things in music. Not in my usual wheelhouse either, but like you found something to groove on. You know, that her voice is very soothing. There's an embracing sultriness about it.
Closer than before.
And that's what I find alluring in the track, because the arrangements are so kind of sparse, really, that it's a perfect juxtaposition. So I think this is a very good arbiter for what may come. I think the new EP that she's putting out is called Syrup. So if there's more tracks in this vein, I am more than willing to give this a full chance.
Yeah, and it was what got me was the fact that initially I thought, oh, it's going with that same kind of, as you said, minimalist kind of thing, like kind of like somebody that I used to know, where it just is, you know, very small instrumentation, and then we, you know, we do something interesting with a chorus or something, and it doesn't do that. It more along the lines of it builds the music in an interesting way behind her as she just sort of talks, sings through the entire thing. And I thought that was the part about it that kind of got me. And I thought, okay, all right, there's more here than I thought there was going to be. And it surprised me. If you want me to like your song, surprise me with it.
Well, that's the beauty of some of these tracks. What you're expecting, especially from publicists' descriptions, which are, I find more often than not, unfortunately, very misleading.
Right.
Which is why more often than not, I go into these moments when I have to listen to something with a bit of trepidation and, okay, open your mind. You know, if you're describing something one way and thankfully it comes out sounding like something else, you're not going to have a problem writing about it, because it's very rare that you do get the accuracy of what the description says on the paper or in the email versus what you're actually listening to.
Right.
And this is one of those moments where it's something that you think is going to be that one way, and like you said, turns out to be something else, which is absolutely fine.
Yeah, and definitely give it a run. And if you get into those first few seconds and you think, oh, this is a kind of music I don't really like very much, stick with it for a little while, because you never know. You may find yourself in that same position where it sort of grows on you. And if you love it from the beginning, well, you know, even better. And that brings us around to the one that kind of left me a little bit flat, that I had great hopes for, and then the things that were done with it, I wasn't as happy with. You and I have talked a lot about Keith Creighton and the fantastic job he does writing and interviewing. And he did in this piece as well. It was just the song that I wasn't all that impressed with. Amelia K. Spicer, who has been around for a little while, I gather, writing songs. And it's country, but it's not exactly the whole new country vibe. And it's not exactly the Americana vibe either. Where would you put her?
I'm going to put her on the periphery of pop, with more pop.
Yeah.
/ I don't want to say alt country, because it's not exactly that.
Right.
But it's more that, you know what, I hate to say it, because I'm in pretty much agreement with you. You know, Keith certainly set the table, but it's also, you know, we're getting it from his opinion, and he's completely embraced this particular track. Well, he was also writing in the context of the album, which I haven't heard. But this particular track, it felt like it wasn't sure where it wanted to go, whether it wanted to be a pop song or still feed the country need.
Yeah. Yeah, and there are some good things here. I mean, her voice is strong. She sounds good. And
she's great. The playing's great. It's just that the song itself is just nothing. You know, it's just nothing special in particular.
Yeah.
But guess what? Like everything else, we may not like this one particular track, but maybe the album's actually pretty good.
Good point. Yeah. And, you know, there were some parts where, you know, getting really picky about the way that songs are constructed, I thought it went to some obvious places. In the same way that the song we were talking about before from Chantal Monte surprised me, this one didn't as much. And it went from a dry voice in the first verse to a dry voice with a two-part harmony above it for the second half of the second verse. And I thought, yeah, you know, if I was scripting one out for a country hit, that's what it would have.
Right.
But if it had gone with a single harmony over top, it probably would have meant more.
It's almost, you know, by the numbers, if you will.
Right, right.
You know, and the fact is, you know, and I'll be fair, you know, we're focusing in on the one track that we both heard,
yeah,
which is what I'm saying, and, you know, didn't love it. But there are a couple of other songs on there that I have to admit, I haven't had the chance to sit down and listen to, you know, like Fill Me Up or Harlan, you know.
Hey.
but you know, this one particular track wasn't it. Okay, fine. The great thing is there are others for us to sample. And if those erase the not positive vibe of this one, then we can go ahead and see, you know, what the overall takeaway is.
Yep. And the album is called Wow and Flutter, which is funny because it goes into the studio noises that were the same kind of genesis for the album name Rattle and Hum. I'm looking forward to hearing some more of it because, as we said, the voice is certainly there and the playing is pretty outstanding on this too. So go check it out. Keith Creighton's got the interview with Amelia K. Spicer, and there's a couple of songs that you can sample on the review page at Popdose. And you also checked in with the one that, unfortunately, this is the foibles of the internet. I couldn't get it to play. So you're going to have to take the helm on this one and tell us about Zephaniah Ohora.
Yeah, he just completely threw me for a loop because I was expecting this to be some kind of... Actually, I didn't know what I was expecting it to be. But I can tell you this much about him. He's, believe it or not, based in Brooklyn. Actually, maybe that's not to be surprising. But he's Brooklyn-based. And you listen to this and immediately all you can picture are, and you want to talk about country, you know, sawdust covered wooden floors, you know, the sort of dank stench and vibe of an old fashioned country bar.
Nice.
And I'm telling you, if I'm guessing, and that's all I'm doing, if I'm guessing right, I think some of his influences have to range from, you know, Merle Haggard, Don Williams, and the CBers' friend, Red Sovine, because this guy, for as young a man as he is old country. Good. And I mean old. You listen to him, and he sounds aged. You know, it's funny. I heard Dave Dudley's 6 Days on the Road in the car this morning, and it didn't sound anything dissimilar to this. You know, I'll give you a good example. Way Down in My Soul is – akin to that kind of sound. You know, it's got that classic nature and feel of an old styled country track, you know, pedal steel runs. It's got a soft kind of tempo, rich background harmonies. And then of course the yearnings of love lost, you know, and in this case, he does it in a very poetic way. And just to give you a line from the song, which is pretty good mastery of wordsmithing. She's a mystic stream in a poet's gold.
Nice. I like that. I am definitely going to have to check this guy out. And, you know, it's funny because when you talk about sounding old, and not only vocally sounding old, but having the music have that vintage feel to it as well. That's the great thing about being alive now is that tape still exists. Tube amps still exist. I had a conversation earlier this week with Little Steven Van Zandt, and he and his soul band have a new album out. And we talked about that because it has a very 1968, 1969 kind of feel to it. And he said, yeah, we didn't use anything newer than that. Our B3 is a B3.
You have what you just said about tape. You have the old instruments and the tube amps.
Yep.
But the most important thing you can have is the love and appreciation and understanding of that music, that
right.
style. I mean, this could have come right out of any time between 1960 and 1972.
Yep.
You know, the thing is, though, he kind of moves in quasi, and I'm saying quasi, contemporary styles, because there's a track on there called Take Your Love Out of Town, which it's very familiar because the rhythm and the feel reminds me of Lion Eyes, right?
Yeah.
If we're getting contemporary, we're only getting contemporary to the mid-70s.
Right.
But then there's a track called I Can't Let Go, Even Though I See Your Fit, Set You Free. And it just sounds like it walked right out of Nashville in 62, you know? It's got that kind of Ray Price feel to it.
Yeah.
So here's someone who's obviously probably, if not in our age range, younger than we are, in Brooklyn, even though I don't know if he's a Brooklyn native, and he's got this obvious knowledge. No, let me retract that. Depth of knowledge and understanding of a music that has in many ways been abandoned.
Right. And having that kind of appreciation and that the derogatory term now is geekery for something like that. It has its benefits, and those benefits are that if you really delve deeply enough into it, you can start to imbue yourself in something that can stoke those creative fires and take you back into that same direction. So very cool that he's being creative in that way. Zephaniah Ohora's This Highway is the brand new one that's out from him. And I want to move away from music a little bit because we've got a whole bunch going on in terms of TV and streaming and movies. And, you know, one of these days, Rob, we're going to find something that you and I will actually argue about. But it kills me when I get an email from you and it says, you know, I was never really into Twin Peaks. And I think, yeah, no, I know. I think I watched it once.
Well, I watched it for the obvious reason. I mean, first of all, let's put it, let us, like, as it should be done, let's put it in context. You know, it first appeared in 1990. So that's 27 years ago.
Yep.
So I was 27 years younger,
uh-huh.
And so was Sherilyn Fenn and Laura Flynn Boyle,
right.
And that was the reason why I watched it full stop,
mm-hmm.
because those were two of the most incredible, breathtaking women I'd ever laid my eyes upon,
yeah.
as most of the world who saw them, and I was instantly smitten with both, probably more with Laura Flynn Boyle, actually, but nevertheless, those two captivated me for quite a time, but the fact is, the show itself, I'm not a fan of David Lynch. That doesn't help either.
Mm.
You know, you want to go in with best intentions and like that obligatory sense of having to dig something that's in and new and on or on the radio or whatever the case may be. Everyone, all and sundry around me, just heap the praise to the skies on high with this. And all I could think to myself was, it's being weird for the sake of being weird.
Right.
And that doesn't make it particularly interesting, riveting, or enough to keep my attention through an entire episode. So to hear the whole hyperbole about, oh my God, David Lynch is bringing back Twin Peaks, I say, big fucking deal.
Yeah, and with me, it was the movie. It was Twin Peaks Firewalk with Me, because, and for the very same reason, because I had a thing for Moira Kelly, who is in that movie. And in fact, there's a lot of her in that movie. But, you know, you mentioned Laura Flynn Boyle. The first time I think I ever saw her face, I was in the theater in probably 88 or 89, and there to watch something, don't even remember what it was, and a preview came on for the movie The Temp. And that was the first time I had ever seen her. And immediately I thought, wow, I'm going to have to find a reason to go watch that stupid looking movie because she was amazing.
I always thought she was going to be a bigger star, to be honest with you.
Yeah.
You know, she had that star quality about her. She had that presence. She certainly had that beauty. She had the cuteness.
Right.
She had the sexiness. She had the voice. You know, she had all the makings of someone who could be a complete and utter superstar.
And she didn't look like everybody else.
No.
Yeah.
But at the same time, she looked like somebody that I could have dated.
Right. And yeah, there's that accessibility thing.
Right, right. I mean, there are some women, you look at them, you know, the women on screen, and you think, nah, I could never go out with her. And then there are those you look at and say, yes, I could go out with her.
You know, definitely. And I just looked it up, too, and it turns out The Temp was actually 1993, so there's proof that I never really watched Twin Peaks, because it was out before that.
I actually thought The Temp was a made-for-TV movie.
No, yeah, that was a theatrical release.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. But, I've had zero interest in the Twin Peaks revival. I'm not great with revivals as it is. You know, I think you and I have probably talked about this subject over the years, but when something ends, it ends for a reason.
Yep.
Whether it's a show that gets canceled, a band breaks up, whatever the case may be. To try and revive it, especially after X amount of years, and in this case, you know, series-wise, 27 years. And when was Firewalk with Me? 93?
Yeah, right around the same time, right.
So that's still 24 years later. You can't recapture that lightning in a bottle. You're surely going to get the diehards and fans who love that show so much that even if it was the worst piece of shit they've ever seen, they're going to say they love it simply because it's it.
Yep.
Look, they're bringing back Roseanne. They're bringing back Will and Grace. Why?
Yeah, yeah. And
there's such a dearth of good writing out there that you've got to revive these shows that have been off for more than a decade.
Well, the only way that it works, that we've seen it work anyway, and sometimes it does and sometimes it crashes and burns miserably, is when you do the whole reboot. You get a brand new cast, you get brand new writers, it has only a sort of a thread back to the original source material. That can work, but yeah, when you're just bringing back the same cast 20 years later and throwing them up there and going, okay, let's do this again, there's nothing left in the tank. That's why they stopped.
Exactly. And yeah. It's also embarrassing because I don't really feel like watching the same sort of lines and scenarios being played out, because that means you haven't progressed one iota.
Right, right. And it doesn't work anymore, because what was funny and what was compelling in 1993 isn't anymore. We've been through 30 years of history since then. So yeah, there's all kinds of reasons why this is the wrong thing, but there are some things going on that also bear a little bit of scrutiny. You have not yet seen the Wonder Woman movie, correct?
No, not yet. I'm not a fan of comic books. I've never read comic books. Mm-hmm. I do go to see the Marvel films, mainly because my wife really likes them a lot. So I'm always, happy to oblige. And every one of them that I've seen so far has been enjoyable. You know, whether it was Ant-Man, which I think is a terrific movie.
Yeah.
The Avengers films have been really enjoyable. The Captain America films have been really enjoyable. But Wonder Woman, we haven't gone yet. I think this was opening weekend, so we'll probably go within the next 2 or 3 weeks once the crowd simmered down a little bit.
Right. See, and that's part of living in a tiny little town like we do. Even movies that are huge box office, you can still catch a show where there's only four or five other people in there. And that was the case when my lovely bride and I, Jen, went and saw Wonder Woman last night. And all of the hype, I have not seen one negative review on this movie yet. And that's good. So I figured, okay, well, I'm like you. Comic book movies, okay, sure. The worst they are is fine. And so I went in with kind of high hopes on this one. And we watched it, and it was fine. There were the same plot holes as there are in every superhero movie that they just fill up with ass-kicking and superhero stuff, and okay, it's kind of a lazy device, but all right, fine. The thing is, I had heard so much hype based on, we finally have a real woman superhero, and I thought, okay, sure, but can we make a good movie with her? that seems like, to me, it would be the bigger trick, and I just don't know that they did. It suffers from the very same downfall that all of the superhero movies have, because the plot line is always the world could end if this goes badly. But the thing is, the world is never going to end, because if it does, they can't make a sequel. So going in, that what the end of the movie is going to be. The end of the movie is going to be, there's going to be this big boss level fight between the superhero and the supervillain, and the supervillain's probably not exactly what you think the supervillain's going to be, and then there's a big fight, and we already know who wins, roll credits. And that's what this movie is.
And then you see now the new device of all these comic book movies, the device is, after the credits roll, there's a teaser that's going to entice into either the sequel, or in the case of Marvel, another episode from the Marvel Universe.
Uh-huh. And I'm glad you said that, because, not to be a spoiler, but in Wonder Woman, there isn't one. They don't do anything. They roll credits, and then it goes black, and everybody stayed. Even though there were only probably 10 or 15 other people in the theater, everybody stayed. And when the credits stopped, and everything went black, and the lights came up, there was an audible, aww.
People, there's a predictability now with that. Notice, right. They become imbued with the notion of, okay, we got to see, because at the end we're going to see something. Don't forget,
right,
in the last couple, they've had two teasers that are not exactly aligned. Case in point, Ant-Man had two teasers, one that would lead into the sequel.
Right.
And the very last one that was leading into the next Captain America movie.
Right, the spinoff. Right, sure.
So, maybe in its own way it's a good thing, because this way you defied automatic expectation,
mm-hmm.
predictability. I don't know. I'll say this much about the Wonder Woman thing. And this is a Marvel film, correct?
No, DC, because Wonder Woman was there in the Justice League with Superman and Batman and all of them.
Okay, then that's why there wasn't anything at the end.
Yeah, could be.
That's what Marvel will do.
Right.
But at least we did make that very clear distinction.
Yeah.
Because notice how easily I was thinking, that it was a Marvel Comics movie. Okay. I will go see it because, of course, my wife wants to see it. And two, I'm more than happy to support Gal Gadot.
Sure. And the thing is, it's fine.
You know, she's absolutely stunning. I mean, I'm not going to bullshit you.
Yeah.
She's a damn good reason why you would go and see it. And second of all, who she is and what she's about, I appreciate and respect.
Yeah.
And, you know, I will support her 100%.
Yeah, and there's not a bad performance. I don't have anything really negative to say about the movie. There's not a bad performance in it. There's nothing that sticks out as being, oh, God, did they really have to do that? It's just, it's another fine superhero movie. So, yeah.
Let me ask you something, though. In the superhero movies you've watched so far, have you ever sat and thought, this one's so much better than this, and you realize you're enjoying, let's say for argument's sake, Captain America or the Avengers more than seeing the newer Batman or Superman movies?
Yeah, no.
Because I can honestly say if I was going to pick one versus the other, I will take Marvel over DC.
Okay, yeah.
Better storylines. The thing about watching those, you know, DC films, I think the biggest thing that they're missing is the fact that one thing Marvel does inject in its stories is humor.
Mm-hmm.
You know, is a comedic element in every one of those movies I've seen to date. Subtle at times, but to me, I get the jokes, and I think those are important because it keeps it lively.
The one thing they did in this movie I thought was funny, or at least I got a good line out of it, was the main villain that we're kind of building up to throughout the movie is Ares, the god of war, real? And is Ares really behind all of the problem that's going on? Because this takes place, most of it takes place right around the end of World War I. So it's all about, is Ares really out there controlling all of this stuff? And why didn't Zeus kill Ares in the first place back, you know, in the battle for Olympus? And I thought, well, anybody who wants to kill an Ares knows all you have to do is drive it for about 40,000 miles or forget an oil change and the damn thing's going to explode. So it's my child of the 80s humor.
We're going to understand what we're talking about as far as... For those of you who don't know, kids, an Aries is a ram.
That's right. It's a
sign of annoying people who were born in April.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I think
the most famous or infamous Aries ever born was, of course, Hitler. It's also a shitty car made by truck, right? Aries truck.
No,
right?
Those were K cars. It was the Dodge Aries, the Plymouth Velari.
Dodge Ram.
Yeah.
Ram tough. You see?
Right.
See, no matter what, it still has to do with sheep. And they were shitty. The shitty K cars of the 1980s by Chrysler was, yes, the Dodge Aries and, of course, just the plain old brown Chrysler K car.
Right, and the Plymouth Velari.
Wait, no, hang on. I got to take umbrage there because the Velari was a 76.
Yeah, but they kept the name when they went to the K cars. Yeah.
They really?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Because we had a Velari. We had a green... dark green sparkle Velari wagon with brown siding, you know, the brown, shitty brown paper siding,
right,
with an AM radio. We had that car from 1976 to 1988. And yes, I was the one driving the car from about 1985 till its demise.
Right.
That we made it last 13 years is a miracle because in the first 2 years, Velaris and Aspens, the Aspen was the Dodge counterpart, had the most recalls I think I've ever seen of any car at one time. There were so many problems for both those cars, I can't even begin to count them up. I think we spent more time going back and forth to the dealership for the recalls than we did having the Velari in our driveway.
Yeah, but if you look up the later version of it, the 83 Plymouth Velari, you'll see that it's pretty much the Dodge Aries. So, yeah, oh, God, they were so bad. But see, at least in yours, they still had the slant six. So, you know, they hadn't moved to that terrible four-cylinder that just blew up after 40 grand. That said, though, there are some other things to go into on our segment this week. And we're going to go into a little bit of the streaming thing as well, because Netflix hit it out of the park again, at least in terms of viewership. While they canceled a couple of series early, which they haven't done before, they've got this thing now. So it's called The Keepers, and it's about this incident that took place in Baltimore in the late 1960s, where there was a disappearance of a nun, And there was, at the same time, in the same place where she worked, there was a series of girls who later on came to this sort of recovered memory that they had all been sexually abused by the priest who was working at that same school. So it's all about, is there a connection between the sex abuse and the murder of this nun? And it's fascinating. It's a documentary series. I mean, this is not a dramatization of anything. But what occurred to me watching it is that this isn't the first one to do that. I mean, The Killing did this, and there were several others that have reformed the documentary into this sort of bingeable or not package of anywhere between 7 and 13 hours where, you know, you can just watch as much of it as you want. And it made me think, you know, outside of the Ken Burns stuff that aired on PBS, can you imagine if somebody 20 years ago went up to a network and said, hey, we got an 11-hour documentary we want to pitch you on?
Not a one. Well, first of all, the fact that, how many years ago did you just say that was? You were thinking 20 years ago?
Yeah.
20 years ago was 97. You know, maybe HBO
right.
would have been gutsy enough to take the risk, because HBO had already started going into that realm of shows, you know, like Oz, like, I don't remember when Sopranos came on, maybe 98, but they were starting to go into that original programming thing that made them so spectacular from the get. Then again, they were the first ones to have documentary series.
Right.
So, you know, it wouldn't be out of the realm of possibility. Especially something hard-hitting, something graphic, too.
Right, you know? Well, yeah, they did the America Undercover thing, was HBO.
Child sexual abuse and a murder.
Yeah.
Plus, at the time, they were doing Taxi Cab Confessionals, for Christ's sakes.
I remember really, that show.
Really early form of reality TV. So, network definitely wouldn't have, because networks back then still had the grip on everything, since not everybody had cable.
Yeah.
I would say people across the board had cable. At least everyone I knew had it by at least 91, because there was just no way around it anymore.
Yeah.
I mean, just to give you a very quick idea, Staten Island didn't have cable until 88.
Wow.
We had over-the-air subscription TV. We had something called Wometco Home Theater, WHT. Which was a subscription service that ran specific hours. It was broadcast over Channel 68, which had been an independent channel. It was the home of, and I'm sure there are some people out there who are going to recognize this name immediately, the Uncle Floyd Show.
Okay.
WHT would come on at around, I'd say, 8 o'clock each night. They would scramble the signal, and you had to have the decoder box. And WHT ran till about 2, 3 o'clock in the morning, depending on when their night's worth of films would come to an end. By 85, 86, more cable stations were obviously up and running and happening, and we're talking full cable capabilities, like Manhattan Cable and so on. And Cablevision was out there. And in New Jersey, you had United Artists and Columbia Cable.
Right.
And WHT, in and of itself, became completely obsolete, wound up going out of business by 85, and turned into an over-the-air music video channel, which lasted almost 2 years. U68, which bucked completely against MTV. This was the channel where you could see at any given moment during the day the Bongos, Husker Du, REM, the Minutemen. They also had this wonderful show on Friday nights called Nocturnal Transmissions, one episode which was hosted by Robin Hitchcock. Another episode was completely dedicated to The Fall. You know, but unfortunately, that channel went bankrupt and was sold out to Home Shopping Network. Mm-hmm. So that too fell by the wayside. Plus the stranglehold of MTV threatening the record labels with, if you don't take your videos off that free channel, we will not show them on ours. So by 1988, Staten Island finally got what became known as Staten Island Cable, which was an offshoot of Time Warner Cable, who had taken over Manhattan Cable. I don't think we were a full throttle area. We had HBO and we had Showtime available. My parents did not have cable. They didn't bother to get it. When I moved out of our home in 1991, I didn't have it. I didn't get cable myself until 1995 when I couldn't take it anymore. The snapping point for me was I didn't get to watch the 1994 Stanley Cup Finals.
Yeah, right.
I had to sit and listen to it on the radio, which all praises to the man upstairs. All four networks, because Fox did it as well. All four networks saw fit to cut to the Madison Square Garden network feed in the last 5 minutes to see the historic event that the Rangers were, in fact, going to win the Stanley Cup. So I didn't see that at the very least. But, you know, cable TV, I think HBO is the, you know, in the later part of the 90s was the turning point for having a challenging series come on the air. Now, of course, whether it was a scripted series versus a documentary, they set the standard.
Well, yeah, there was, as a matter of fact, that America Undercover thing, that goes back to, I think, 87 or 88 was when they kicked that thing off. And there's a connection there because one of the first things that HBO did on America Undercover was it was a show called Why Did Johnny Kill? That was the title of that episode of America Undercover. And it was about these murderers who committed their crimes when they were 14, 15, 16 years old. And I think they profiled four or five of them. And one of them was a kid who started out with the police explorers, and he was the lifeguard at the local kiddie pool and all of this stuff. And he was like the golden boy, and came home, murdered his entire family, and then tried to kill himself by driving his car, you know, 90 miles an hour in a 30 zone, head-on collision, killed the guy in the other car, but he lived. And it turned out the guy in the other car happened to be his neighbor. And the connection here is that that kid was the lifeguard at the kiddie pool I used to go to when I was a kid. So, yeah, so it turned out I was like, oh, so it was that guy, a kid named John Justice. And ooh, oddly enough. Yeah, right. So, it was, and I thought, yeah, that was the one thing that kind of drew me into that. But yeah, I must have been spoiled. We had cable in Kenmore going back to like 1970. Boy, it must have been 78 because we left there in 79. And I remember we had it for at least a year or two before we went.
Yeah, I mean, New York City, all I know is that on the east side, you had Showtime, and on the west, the burgeoning Showtime network, and on the west side, you had HBO.
Yeah, Showtime I don't think existed yet when we got it in 78. There was HBO there, though.
You know, they definitely did a split between the city.
Yeah, that's wild.
Yeah, there was a buzz always about cable going back to about 78 or so, because that was around the time that Wometco came in, like 77, 78, because that was the first time we'd ever heard of pay TV.
Right. And it started, you remember on the back of the VCR, it used to have that little thing below the coax port where it said CATV.
Yep.
That was Community Antenna Television, and that was a place somewhere near Pittsburgh, because everybody in this one particular valley couldn't get any TV because all of the antennas were on the other side of the mountain. Couldn't get local.
We actually have, we still have a community access channel here, funnily enough. That's one of the last vestiges of the Staten Island cable days. Right. We still have CTV. But, you know, you brought up a really salient point, and I think this is where we should turn into a much more serious nature of the conversation. You know, you brought up murder and what we saw happen last night in England.
Yeah.
Yet again, it just reinforces what kind of social psychosis is sweeping through the world at large right now, whether it's of a political nature or, in this case, a homicidal / religiously fed nature. And you have an upcoming election yet again, certainly a referendum coming up in England of Labour versus conservatism. And you have a president here who does not know when to just not open his mouth / tweet something beyond embarrassing and ridiculous. I'm of the hope that most people around the world realize that he does not speak for everyone.
Yeah.
I hope. But yet again, this does beg the question, and it's a very serious question because it's a completely debatable topic of, you look at the culprits in this recent spate of killings, bombings, murder, because that the attack in Manchester just goes beyond description and defiance. It was a concert, and it was children. if this is where you have to feel a sense of proving your religious manhood by attacking a concert filled with children, then your religion isn't really worth that much, is it?
Right. Right. And follow that with what happened on London Bridge, which it wasn't just London Bridge, but in the area around it, which is a bar district. And it's a bunch of people on a Saturday night going out, having fun at a bar, and you want to drive a truck through them or, you know, start swinging a knife around. And the fact is, the insanity of it, I think, is what we like to focus on, because that's the scary part for us, because anybody could go insane even if they're standing next to you. But I think what gets lost is what they're really attempting to do. And the people who are driving this, pardon the pun, who are driving this kind of violence are doing so for a reason, and it's because they want the war. They feel like, whether it's through religious fervor or whatever, if they don't get the war, if the ultimate conflict doesn't happen between their values and what we take as Western values, then they'll never be able to solidify their place in history and their place in the world. And they know that the only thing that they're capable of doing is occasionally scaring the shit out of people. And if they can do that enough, maybe they'll provoke a war. I worked with September 11th. It provoked not one, but two. So that's really their only move. And when we give in to the instinct to go fly planes and drones and drop bombs and do all of that shit, all it does is feed the beast. And it encourages them. And they think, okay, well, you know, this is working. And if we really want this war to happen, all we have to do is drive a truck through a mass of people again and scare the shit out of everybody.
Well, there is that. But there's also the question of what then do rational people do? Because it's happening everywhere. You know, it is happening everywhere. It's popping up with alarming frequency. You know, you've had it happen, you know, not just the thing with driving a truck through a crowd, but you've had numerous attacks in France. You've had a couple of attacks to a lesser degree in Germany. You've had now several attacks in England. You know, they're obviously spreading their game across different countries.
Right.
What then are people supposed to do? You know, it, and I say that in the sense of we are being told, for lack of a better phrase, told being the operative word here, that it isn't a religion so much as it's extremists. The problem is that people are not able to separate one from the other, and it is a difficult thing to do.
Right.
No, these are Muslim extremists, fanatics, warmongers, terrorists. Call them what you want, but they're of a specific group. You can't turn a blind eye. And the question is, how do you go about trying to make the I hate to say it. How do you go about trying to prevent it from happening? I think the answer, quite frankly, is you can't.
Right.
You can't present it because it's gone into a new form of that kind of guerrilla warfare where you've got copyists, you've got the individual, I think they call them wolf cells, where they'll just, you know that they're part of a network, but they're going to act independently so as not to tie themselves in with another group. It's a case of what do you do? You know, you just sit there and go, oh, well, gee, they were just extremists. Or do you fight back? That's the bigger question at hand that I think most people are starting to ask themselves.
Right, but who do you fight?
Right, and where do you fight?
Uh-huh.
Now, do you go into your neighborhoods where you know these communities are found?
Yeah, you know? And that's the I don't think there's – the problem is not that there's not an answer. The problem is that there's not a satisfying answer because – you look at what happened between England and the IRA and how long that went on and how many lives were taken. And you look at the fact that for years, you know, what was England going to do? Invade? You know, just send planes in to start wiping out neighborhoods in Ireland? No, of course not. So you wouldn't fight this, you know, in a very different way than you fight that. The problem is that took a very long time and it took a lot of lives before things started to calm down and cooler heads prevailed. So really, I mean, right now, you don't have to go back that many years until the problem was a different group of people. And all you do is you do what rational people do. You interdict, you investigate, you arrest people, you do everything that you can to show people, look, there are consequences for these actions. But like you said, can you stop the next nutcase from blowing himself up? No, probably not.
No, and unfortunately, you know, we're also now between the nightmares of the media and these governments that are controlling the, not controlling, the governments that are sitting in place, I should say. You know, you've got Donald Trump's White House, you've got Theresa May's Parliament. It's at the same time, though, and you know, I'm not playing party politics, obviously, because I'm not British. You know, Labor tends to roll over and just say it's fine, you know, and that's kind of ignoring the obvious, I think, is far more dangerous. There has to be a sense of vigilance. I'm sorry, you have to have that because you have to be aware of your surroundings at every moment. It certainly seems right now, since this is all going on, and you know, you just can't. It's something that can't be ignored, but the whole Manchester thing really does stick in my craw simply because it was children. You want to talk about negating the meaning of any kind of religious validity, you spill the blood of a child. Then you've negated what religion is about, because religion always holds children in high esteem because they are the ones to carry on the future. They are the ones to carry on the mission, the name, whatever you want to call it, the traditions, the values. You know, this is just getting murkier and murkier, and in the meantime, we're sitting here watching Donald Trump write the stupidest and most embarrassing tweets. Never mind his pompous "We're here for you, Britain in the UK," and you know, "We must reinstate our travel bans." What is Cov Fefty mean?
Oh, good Lord, who knows? Well, what it means is that the Valium took effect in the middle of his tweet, or something along those lines. So, yeah, I picture him. What I was thinking when it happened was he just Elvis'd out on the toilet, you know, in the middle of the tweet, and then just boom. But it didn't happen that way because he was there the next day tweeting again. So who knows? But you know, that at least gave people something fun to be distracted about for a day.
Yeah, I mean, because let's face it, every day is another shit show with Trump. It's just not funny.
What?
Him trying to find a way to block Comey from testifying.
Oh, I hope he does. I hope he uses executive privilege. I really do. Just so I can watch people try to explain it.
That and putting the kibosh on that report. So you're saying now what is and should be public record will not be. Cover, perhaps? You know, and the press giving themselves this wonderful self-congratulatory pat on the back for a job that they haven't been doing. You know, as you have said so many times, it's your fucking job.
Well,
you
and you know, that also played itself out in a slightly different arena this week because twice we had comedians apologize for jokes that they made. Kathy Griffin did it, and at the end of the week, Bill Maher did it for something that he said on Real Time. And look, I personally, I could never care less about Kathy Griffin. It doesn't make any difference. Is she funny? Is she not funny? Was it in poor taste? Was it over the line? What fucking line? Okay, tell Lenny Bruce where the line was. Tell George Carlin where the line was, and then we can talk about a line. But the thing is, it doesn't matter. When you're gonna do that kind of comedy, it's going to make people uncomfortable. And to then back off of it and apologize and give this weepy appearance on TV about, oh, Donald Trump and his family ruined my life. Kathy, buck the fuck up, please. And as far as Bill Maher is concerned, what he did, it was a long and involved line of sort of free form with him and Congressman Sasse, or Senator Sasse, rather. And they got into something about costumes and slavery, and it was this long and involved conversation, and the punchline that Bill Maher went for was, "No, I'm a house nigger." Now, when he said it, there was this kind of thud, and Sasse didn't really laugh, and the audience didn't really laugh, and then after the show, all of a sudden, the entire world is incensed about Bill Maher. Let's start with this. No, they're not. you know, it's manufactured outrage, the same as we've seen now for the last 20 years. It's just the other side doing it. But the thing is, Bill Maher tried to make a joke that nobody laughed at. Well, I'm sure he's the first comic to ever have that happen. But what did he do? The heat got turned up, and he backed off and apologized. This is the guy who has been sitting there on his show on Real Time for the last couple of months going, what's wrong with the Democrats? How come they won't fight? The Republicans are the only ones fighting, and the Democrats just sit back and go, yeah, I guess you're right. And what does he do at the first opportunity? The same thing.
Yeah, he backs down and kowtows because everybody now is completely pussified.
Yep.
By the new extreme left.
Right.
You know, it's the moral outrage, social justice warriors, the precious petals, call them what you will. They get it. Look, never mind Kathy Griffin, because I'm not even going to address it. You know, she's an imbecile. She yep. isn't funny. What she did was pretty tasteless, and there are consequences when you do shit like that. Yeah, nobody really put consequences on Ted Nugent, but Ted Nugent has been doing this shit for 100 years, you know?
Yeah.
Sooner or later, the bottom will drop out on him, you know? The point is, Kathy Griffin just wants to have some kind of gig because otherwise people will realize she's not worth paying.
She, right, you know? The talent isn't there anyway. Right, exactly.
But, you know, a couple of things. One, if you asked Lenny Bruce where the line was and he told you where it was, he would probably get life in front of a firing squad. You know, don't forget, Lenny Bruce was the guy who said, you know, you can say a million dirty words and you know, curse up a storm, you know, and say that I'm obscene. You want to talk about dirty and obscene? Hiroshima was obscene.
Yep.
You know, that was dirty. When you put it in context, a really good comic, you know, puts thought into what his response reaction is going to be, and he's going to stand his ground. George Carlin was the master because he knew how to play the Lenny Bruce card, but he also knew how to take it right to the precipice and not fall off or be pushed off.
Right.
Into an accidental no-no.
Yeah.
For all intents and purposes. Modern comics don't have any of that. They're all retreads and desperately wanting to be like. Wanting to be like is the kiss of death.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So, you know, to get away from all of that, the Bill Maher thing, you know, it's just more of the same shit that the left is doing. And, you know, that goes along with my whole concept of people really need to be put back in their place one way or the other, whether it's done in an argumentative fashion. I mean, really, arguing doesn't get anybody anywhere because it's just who can yell the loudest, you know, who can piss the highest. I was reading a thing that was not a joke about there was some guy who was pretty pissed off and tired of the whole thing where they were having women only screenings for Wonder Woman.
Right, right.
And I have to tell you, a woman who I know very well and respect an enormous amount said, that is one of the biggest loads of bullshit I've ever heard in my life. Why the fuck should there be women-only screenings for this movie? It's a fucking fantasy comic book movie. Where is the social value of it? It's a fucking movie. And the fact is, when did it become that men are just so responsible for every single thing that happens in this world? Now it's a case of being, you know, a bunch of, you know, do-gooder feminist bullshitters, you know, who will completely crab and bitch about the same stupid things. And if it isn't this week, they'll find something else to piss and moan about because these are just genuinely miserable human beings.
Right.
Not because they're men or women, because they're just generally unhappy about one thing or the other in their lives. Probably a good portion of it is by the choices that they have made, and now they're trying to redeem themselves when they're that far down in the abyss.
Yeah, and the only time, and I've actually been to screenings like this before, is if you're doing a screening with the intent in mind to have some kind of focus group afterwards. There was a movie that came out many, many years ago, and there were several members of the prominent African-American community in Tampa that were invited to a screening of a movie called White Man's Burden. And the movie itself was mediocre, but it was trying to make a particular point about race by flipping the roles. So it was interesting on that level. And I took part in the focus group afterwards, asking questions and all of that. And that was, you know, everybody in the audience that was invited was African-American. But it was for a reason, and it wasn't a screening that was open to the public anyway, you know? So there are reasons to do that kind of thing, but yeah, grand scheme of things, unless it's something like that, if it's just, hey, let's all get exalted together, oh, come on, open the doors and let people go see a movie.
Well, I'll tell you something. This person who I was speaking to, and again, I said a very wise individual,
yeah.
You know, she said, the whole notion of all these nouveau feminists is that they wouldn't know what feminism truly is if it bit them on the ass, because it's only a flag of convenience for them up until They find something else to distract them.
When did feminism become separatism?
Well, that was her next statement, you know. Like, good luck with that, you know. It's like when you have a woman who suddenly is victimized because she's in a bad marriage or bad relationship. No, it's called, that's what happens when you make a choice in life. It's called life.
Yep.
You take a chance on a relationship. It could turn out good. It could turn out bad. The person you were with may not be a very nice person, but guess what? It happens to men too. And a man can't say anymore without reprisals, no, it turns out she was just a really horrible and mean-spirited bitch.
Yeah, I've never run into any of those. Wait, yes, I have. So anyway, got a few more things to kick around. And actually, I believe it's time to bring it back around. Oh, and the one comic, by the way, that I would say that really has an idea of how to play that game of walking out over the edge and then dragging you back with him is Jim Jefferies, the Australian comic. He's wonderful, and he's got his own show coming up on Comedy Central in the not-too-distant that I'm really looking forward to seeing. But he's a guy that, boy, you see him live when he's completely unfiltered, and he'll take you to those places where you're ready to turn on him, and then he brings it right back. He's a talented cat.
You know, it's funny, no pun intended, but in a lot of ways, Jim Norton is like that.
Yeah.
But he will go right over the edge,
yep,
because he's not afraid to do that.
Right.
And plus the shock / gross out humor. But when he does bring up topics that are thought-provoking, he doesn't mince his words. I'll never forget, he did in his, I think it was his 2008 special Monster Rain. He talked about the big controversy of Don Imus and his famous comment about, or infamous comment about,
nappy-headed hose, yeah.
Yep. Yep, and what they did to him, because it was a witch hunt. And then also the incredible hypocrisy that went on afterwards. You know, people like Tim Russert and Jeff Greenfield. You know, basically the rats abandoning the ship.
Mm-hmm.
Longtime collaborators and friends of Imus, just all of a sudden, oh, it was such an awful thing that he said and he did, you know. And then Hillary Clinton, you know, going to meet with the basketball team to begin the healing.
Yes, from all of the people who were socially devastated by what Imus said. Oh, yeah. God.
Yeah, but the way Norton went about doing it, he did it the right way. He took you not over the edge. He made you look over into what was down below,
yep,
into the pit of the snapping bulldogs.
Yeah.
You know, they're waiting for more blood.
And I'm waiting for more of that kind of thing to happen, because people need to be shaken up, especially now when this phony outrage business has become its own cottage industry. Fuck that. So that said, we've got it's time to go a little in our heads for this week, because we always love to end the show on a high note. And this has become so much fun just talking about things that have occurred to us over the course of this week. And there's a quality about music that you and I have gone over before, and we've talked about the fact that a good song has, whether it's a song that you're hearing for the first time or whether it's a song that you've held with you since kidhood, has the ability to transport you. And when you listen to a song and it takes you to a different place in your mind, that's when something has really made that connection. But a lot of times it has that nostalgic bit to it. And what occurred to me was, with a lot of the songs that have meant something to me, whether it was my own car or whether it goes back as far as my own kidhood, where I was listening to music in my parents' car, that's where I go. It all has to do with not only going to a time and place, but being in a car and going from one place to the other while I'm getting there. And give you an example, Tommy by The Who was an 8-track that my dad had, and played that thing until all of the oxidizer on the tape just wore off and it wouldn't go anymore. And so whenever I hear any of the songs off of that album, I find myself sitting in the backseat of my dad's 1970 Camaro Rally Sport. And there's a couple more that I'll get to, but I'm curious about that, about what the car is for you. And, you know, especially if it's one of yours from like the high school days or something like that, that a song will always take you back to either behind the wheel or sitting in the passenger seat.
The car is a lot. It is a lot, especially in my childhood, for certain. As we've talked about, you know, my parents' Opel Kadett wagon, the red Opel Kadett wagon, it was a 69, I think. 69 or 70, I really can't remember. We got it in September of 72, considering we'd been living in Staten Island since December 1967. So we went for 5 years without wheels. And once we got the car, you know, it became vitally important in terms of hearing new music. Now, when I say new music, we're talking about the latest pop hit singles on radio stations like WNBC and WABC AM, because that was all we had was an AM radio. WHN, which had been a pop station up to that point, switched formats to become a country station. Every now and then we would tune in, so that's where I got my teeth cut on what I consider now to be, you know, classic country music. Songs that still live with me to this day, and you know, when I hear it, I am reminded of those days. But nevertheless, you know, I think of songs with that when I hear them now, I am automatically catapulted back to being in the back seat with my cousins Valerie and Leslie, and we were all of, you know, 8, 9, 10 years old, and whenever the songs would come on, we basically knew them and loved them so much we'd start singing. And it was always, you know, we always had our set favorites, the three of us. And it was always Queen and Elton John and certainly Paul McCartney and Wings. Yeah, but there were also those, you know, those great one-hit wonders, because that was the era for these things. You know, songs like Run, Joey, Run.
He says he's gonna make you pay for what we've done. He's got a gun, so
Come and Get Your Love, Blackwater, you know, Help Me by Joni Mitchell. You know, these were all huge when we were little kids, and these were constantly in rotation on the AM stations.
I'm glad you said Blackwater, because that's got another funny car connection for me. I had a Plymouth Turismo in 1987, and boy, what a dog that thing was. And I noticed that the guy who had put the radio into that car did so poorly that all he did was connect the speaker wires from the left-hand side to all four speakers in the car. So I only ever got left channel on it.
I'd like to hear some funky Dixieland. Pretty mama, come and take me by the hand. I want a honky tonk, pretty honky mama, tonk, with you all night long. I'd like to hear some funky Dixieland. Pretty mama, come and take me by the hand. I want a honky tonk, pretty honky tonk.
When I had my first car in '87, which was a '69 Cutlass,
yeah.
same thing happened.
Well, what it,
The working right speaker.
right. And what ended up happening was I was listening to Blackwater, and that's when I realized something was extremely wrong, because when it got to the a cappella part, I was only getting half of it.
So annoying.
Right.
But the other thing, you know, when you said high school, by the end of high school, I was finally driving there on my own, borrowing my mother's 76 Velari. If I was going to go, I was going in style, obviously.
Sure.
And that was, you know, that was May and June of '83. So what I would do is, because we only had an AM radio in that car, I would take my boombox with me. And the radio was always stuck on WLIR. You know, I always had it stationed right there, 92.7, or I would take tapes with me. But at that point on LIR, I would leave it on the radio more often than not, because in early '83, that's when they were playing some really incredibly great things. So certain songs that always come back to me that are, again, car songs, Whistle Down the Wind by Nick Hayward, which was his first solo single after Haircut 100. Yeah, Radio Free Europe.
Definitely.
Radio Free Europe, Catapult, and Talk About the Passion were the three songs that WLIR always played. But I think it was because Radio Free Europe was side one of Murmur, Catapult started side two of Murmur, and of course, Talk About the Passion was bound to be the second single off the album. So that's another one. But that was early '83, so that's why those songs come to mind. Oh God, Is There Something I Should Know by Duran Duran? That was just about when they were to hit number one for the first time in the American charts. Certainly The Police, Every Breath You Take, although that's a song I just never need to hear for as long as I live.
I tell you what, I'll leave you with one more while you're thinking,
Okay.
because I teased you with this before we went on the air or on tape with this one this afternoon. that in 1987, so the year before I got that Plymouth Turismo, I was making a road trip. I was moving back to Western New York from Florida. So I had about a 20-hour journey ahead of me and went out the day before I left. And for $200 at Terry Kramer and Sons Automotive in Tampa, which is just this horrible buy here, pay here lot that's been there forever, I bought a 1971 Ford LTD. Massive fucking car. The thing weighed 4,400 pounds and it was about 18 feet long. It was just unbelievable. And it was a two-door too, but it was still 18 feet long. So bought that car for $200 and drove it from Florida to New York. And what I didn't count on, this would have been December, mid-December of 1987. And also realized that, as soon as I got out on the road, that car also only had an AM radio in it. So I was going from AM pop station to AM pop station, and George Harrison's Got My Mind Set on You remake had come out about a month and a half before, and it seemed like every time one station faded out and I got to another, I had to go rolling through the dial to another station, it was playing Got My Mind Set on You. I must have heard that song 47 times between Tampa and Buffalo.
Yeah. that you said the magic words, road trip, and a song that you basically never want to hear ever again.
Yep.
And I was on my first road trip actually in early August of 87 with my girlfriend and her family. We were going down to their timeshare in Myrtle Beach, South Carolina for a week. And we left on a Saturday night directly from work. And there were two songs, three, but one you didn't hear as much as the other two, but two songs just kept playing because as you'd get beyond a certain point, the stations would fade in and out.
Right? Yeah.
And you'd lose signal of one and pick up signal of another. And Luca, La Bamba, and The Power of Love.
Yeah.
I just never, ever, ever want to hear ever again because the fact that I know all the words to all three fucking songs really puts me off to no end. You fall asleep when you're on the road. It's a long drive. It's a 12-hour drive from Staten Island all the way down to, including stops to Myrtle Beach. And even though this was overnight, we drifted off, fall asleep, wake up, and one of those fucking songs is playing.
Yeah.
And it would just drive me absolutely crackers. But when I made the road trip myself in 91 with the same girl, we had a bunch of cassettes, but there were a couple that just kept making the rounds over and over again. Either it was me wanting to hear them or her wanting to hear them. But I remember as we made our approach towards the North Carolina border, here's the quick story. We'd stopped to see friends of ours in Norfolk on the way down as a surprise. And we joined them, followed them down to Nags Head, North Carolina,
mm-hmm.
to play a show. The show ended. We spent the night hanging out with them. We had no alcohol because we had this long drive. We said goodbye to them at around 3:30 in the morning. Now by this time, we were tired beyond words. The road that would lead us from Nag's Head and take us into the Grand Strand of Myrtle Beach was simply two lanes going and coming. Very little of it had lights.
Yep.
So this was a dark and creepy, desolate highway. And, I remember driving. We had the radio on fairly low because I wanted to pay strict attention and stay as awake as I could as possible. And at a point, all of a sudden people appeared on the side of the road walking. It was like seeing ghosts.
Yeah.
As it turned out, it was like, these all-night revival church meetings.
Oh, wow. So
folks were going home. But it was eerie to see this nevertheless. And I felt a point where the tiredness was just overtaking me. So I popped one of those tapes in. And when I say I turned it up loud, it could have blown the speakers easily. I mean, they weren't great speakers. I was driving my car at that time, which had become an 88 brand. It was my college graduation gift from my parents, an 88 Pontiac Le Mans, the four-door version.
Mm-hmm.
And this was 91 when we were doing this trip. And it was Rubber Soul, actually, on cassette. So Rubber Soul sustained me as far as, I want to say, from about, let's say, 3:50, 4 o'clock in the morning till 4:30. Then she popped in REM's Out of Time. And when that one was done, I finally said, look, I got to pull over for a while and get some sleep. Otherwise, you take the wheel. So she put in Pisces, Aquarius, Capricorn, and Gemini.
Yes.
And I started to doze. And then at a point, I don't know how late it was, but then she had pulled over as well and said, I can't drive anymore because I'm exhausted. Mm-hmm. And I think it was about 5-ish. And I said, you know what? I've gotten a little bit of rest. I'll take it from here. And I kept going, and I put Reckoning in there. And again, at maximum volume, because first of all, Reckoning sounds great loud.
Yep.
You know, and that's a record that has so much energy and no pun intended drive to it. It will indeed keep you awake. And I pulled out maybe 10 minutes into driving. You could see the first cracks of the sun coming up over the horizon, and I see the beacon. Now, you know, I'm driving. At this point, it's about 6:30-ish, and I see the Beacon of Hope, and it was a Dunkin' Donuts that had just opened.
Sweet.
So and this was turning into a Sunday morning, and they were actually open. You know, I figured down south they might not be open till later, but no, they just opened. So we both went in, and we loaded up on so much caffeine and sugar. And got the jolt that was necessary, and took it all the way down. And the other record that we, you know, we put in was Murmur, you know. So it was basically a sustained road trip of REM, The Beatles, and The Monkees.
Hey, you could do worse.
In background, and we got down there about 9:30, and when I say the crash came on at about an hour and a half later, you know, you felt the downturn from all that sugar and caffeine.
Oh, yeah.
And It was painful. It was like writhing on the bed, kind of. You know, that sticks with me as road trip music, but that's of a positive nature.
Yeah, good man. Well, we're going to leave it at that. We do have one sad goodbye to say to this week, and it happens to be a band that broke up that you and I had kind of high hopes for, but a couple of guys who had been playing together and now won't be. Who are we talking about?
We're talking about the band that started out known as Elder and then changed their name to Vost. The band of young men from Memphis who, yeah, there was a lot of hope and a lot of good feelings and spirit there with some very, very lush, really well-constructed pop songs that were danceable. They were rocking. They were thought-provoking. And it was just this last week or so that I saw on Andrew Elder, who is the lead singer and main director of this band, on his Facebook page saying that for the time being, they have all mutually decided to, quote, put this project down. So yeah. It is a sad thing because when a new band comes along that you get excited about, you want to see good things and great things happen from them. You know, the last time we experienced this was when that wonderful band Little Chief called it a day not too long after we had the joy of hearing and reviewing their album when we were in our original incarnation. But, yes, good things come to an end. But at the same time, the beauty of it is, like Little Chief, Voss has left us with some wonderful music that we will always be able to draw back on when those moments come. And I think on next week's show, that's going to be part of what we're going to talk about, because I want to talk about a band that is very, very near and dear to me on so many personal levels, let alone musical levels, that have never really gotten their due. So that's all I'm going to leave you with as far as the teaser goes.
All right, very good. Well, we'll look forward to that, and we'll find out who that is next time we get together on Radio City. Rob Ross, always a pleasure, my friend.
Thank you very much, sir. Have a good week. Stay well, and I will talk to you next week.
More, of course, everywhere that you look on popdose.com, so go take part in it. Find yourself something you like, put some words down in the comments section, and enjoy some videos, some music, and a little bit of everything elsewhere on popdose.com, and we'll talk to you next time.